Welcome to episode number 36 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And today's guest is video game historian, journalist, and content creator Kim Justice, who's here today to talk to us about Jurassic Park Trespasser, a commercial and critical disappointment that had a surprising amount of influence despite all that. Kim recently released an excellent documentary about the game on YouTube, which we will link in the show notes. Go give it a watch. Kim, welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
Hello, Frank. Hello, Kelsey. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
Kim, what is Trespasser? What are we talking about here?
So I think the best way to sum up Trespasser, I think it is a complete, as a game in many ways, it is a complete failure. It was incredibly overambitious that they were trying to make the best game of all time, pretty much the most advanced game for 1998. It's obviously based in the Jurassic Park franchise, kind of a sequel to The Lost World. They were trying to do things with physics, things with outdoor environments, things with AI that pretty much no game was doing. I mean, we're still in times when Quake is the big shooter of the era. And they tried all these things and they just could not quite get it. Technical limitations basically stop them, other things behind the scenes, and the game is a critical and commercial failure. And despite that, it's influenced so many other games over the years and has a very dedicated community towards it that's kind of kept the game going all this time despite it being such a flop, which not many other games like that can really say. I mean, how much influence does a game like Superman 64 have, or Big Rigs, or Ride to Hell? Nothing compared to Trespasser.
At least not on other video games. I would say that, you know, nowadays you have sort of this cult fascination almost around bad games.
Oh, yes, for sure.
Particularly in the YouTube sphere and the sort of like angry video game nerd type content. But yeah, I don't know how many of those actively inspired other developers.
Right. You might be inspired to, you know, make something janky as a joke or something based on, right? But but yes, it's not often. I mean, when we're talking about influencing games, I mean, we're talking about like Half-Life 2.
You know, like, yes, we're talking about the physics in Half-Life 2. Other games like Far Cry, which really kind of gear themselves more towards outdoor environments. I mean, I think even to this day, you can still find Trespasser's DNA in various games. Even Half-Life Alyx has Alyx counting the bullets out, you know.
Oh, does she? I didn't even realize that connection. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So yeah, extremely ambitious game. Didn't quite hit its marks, but you know, this didn't come out of nowhere. There's kind of almost a dream team put together to make this PC game that was supposed to be the best PC game.
Yes, I mean, well, you had most of the people came from Looking Glass Studios. So, I mean, they'd worked on games like Ultima Underworld, System Shock 1. Seamus Blackley, who headed up the project, obviously pretty well known for the Xbox eventually, he'd done Flight Unlimited. So they'd all had work that was very close, like top of the range in that field of like first-person gaming, 3D gaming. Obviously, Looking Glass themselves are also very known for like their ambitious ideas. They certainly weren't lazy developers, those team. So, yeah, there's not, I mean, short of obviously getting like John Carmack and John Romero and stuff, people like that into it, it's a pretty good team. Like, if you wanted a game like that to produce such an ambitious game, it wouldn't be too far from the team that eventually made Trespasser. They weren't hacks, you know.
And so, you know, let's talk about what it is they were going for. I mean, you point this out in the documentary that, you know, first person shooters were kind of the king on PCs at the time, but for the most part, you know, there's sort of these tight corridors and it's mostly just twitch action. There's not a lot of, you know, thoughtful play, I guess I would say. So I mean, put us in their heads, right? Like what was the dream of Trespasser?
Of course. So Seamus Blackley and Austin Grossman, they saw games like Quake 2, which are very celebrated for their innovation, but they thought, well, it's just still like corridor-based shooter, as you said. So they wanted something that wasn't necessarily just a first-person action game. They wanted it to be more of an immersive, quite open experience. And they weren't necessarily, it wasn't like they immediately thought, oh, we'll do it in Jurassic Park universe. But when it came down to actually finding a developer who were going to let them do such a thing, DreamWorks, which was still fairly new at the time, basically said to them, we will let you do this thing and we'll give you as much time as you need. We'll give you pretty much as much money as you want. We really like the idea, as long as you set it in the Jurassic Park universe and you kind of make this sequel, this virtual sequel to The Lost World.
As far as having to use an IP is concerned, I feel like Jurassic Park is a pretty good, pretty fun one.
Definitely.
Work with dinosaurs stuff.
Absolutely. It works well for something like that when you think about it.
So you talk about this in the documentary, but what are some of these ambitious ideas? I mean, we've got like crazy AI on the dinos. We've got a lot of like indoor, yes, outdoor stuff that you don't tend to see back in the time.
Absolutely. They wanted dinosaurs to not just behave like regular enemies. They wanted to have like proper behavioral AI that would make them react in so many different ways. They wouldn't necessarily just come and eat you. Some dinosaurs would be very passive. Some would call to their tribe. Some would, if they were hungry, you know, if they're thirsty, they'll go and get a drink of water from a source. They wanted that. They wanted the physics to be far beyond pretty much any other game that had gone before. They wanted dinosaurs. I mean, ideally, they wanted like the bigger dinosaurs, your T-Rex and what have you, to be able to rip the roof of a structure. Like, they wanted the buildings to be part of the physics engine too. They weren't in the end, but that was the idea. And you see things like that in the trailers and in the pictures that they released for the game before release. So that was a big part of it. As far as like the game as well, again, they wanted it to become this survival horror adventure type thing as opposed to a first person action title. So those are just some of like the really big ideas that the team were playing with.
And you mentioned there's a dream team. So like there's a good team working on this. They're not coming at these ambitions out of nowhere, out of, you know, a lack of understanding of what can be done. I mean, maybe a little bit, but not
at all. Yeah,
not totally, right? So
no, not at all. Yeah. I mean, they obviously knew it was a lot of work. I mean, it ended up being way more work than they'd ever anticipated, but yeah, they weren't just trying this with no skills,
right? Or they weren't you know, it probably was overscoped, let's face it, but
absolutely,
but there was a sense of reality in the scoping, right? I mean, like, it seems to me that the ideas that they had were feasible, theoretically. It's just like you said, a lot of work and
definitely.
Yeah.
And it didn't help. I mean, there were some of the aspects of organization that could have been improved. I mean, Seamus Blackley has said in interviews about the game, he has said that he wished that he didn't, because he tried to take the physics on himself because that was his background. He was he'd done physics at MIT, and he did that for Flight Unlimited. So he tried to do that on himself while still managing the project, which to him was one of the greatest mistakes. He wished he'd had someone who was a project manager. Plus DreamWorks in general, because a lot of the people who were working at DreamWorks, a lot of like the management, they didn't really have that video game experience. I mean, Steven Spielberg was kind of around on the project, but only to as much time as he himself could put in, which...
Yeah, I don't think he's got time to be a project manager on...
Oh, absolutely not. A lot of the time, they were left to their own devices, and Seamus Blackley has wished that someone was there to basically say, look, you know, you can't do this. To just say no, because they did not have that. They thought they had a golden ticket, basically.
Well, and he's committing the game producer sin of also creating the content. I'm sure any developer listening is where, I mean, I am guilty of this myself. It happens, but yeah. So first person exploration. You talk a lot about you know, the sort of how remarkable a large outdoor environment is in this time.
Definitely. I mean, if you just think of like the trees alone in Trespasser, there's thousands of trees in the game, and that was the sort of thing in other games you would only be able to see like a small handful of compared. So just that alone, if you then also take out the various other like more major features that they produced, whether it's Mayan ruins, the actual mountain that you have in the game, any rock features and so on. Just trees alone, in Trespasser is something that's very, very far ahead for 1998.
I mean, it's kind of novel to think about now, but it's like, yeah, there's a lot of trees.
It sounds quaint.
It's important context. And you also give the context that they had some kind of tricks up their sleeve to even increase the draw distance and sort of the, you know, the perceivable world outside you, where there was some of these textures were, or some of the trees and that sort of thing would be 2D for a while and pop in.
Yes, it's something that would have looked better if the game had run better at the time. The sort of having that 2D, they're 2D when you're looking at them from far away, and then they become 3D as you get closer, because so technically most things are in full 3D but far away, but because obviously the game didn't run well, it ends up, the feature kicks in when you're way too close to it, so it just sees, oh, something's 2D. Oh, all of a sudden it's 3D. So the popping, if anything, looks worse than a lot of other titles from the time. But it was a nice idea. It works fine if you play a game, if you play it with some of the more modern mods installed that allows it to run at 60 frames per second, you don't really notice it.
So we mentioned Seamus Blackley earlier, and that he was in charge of the physics of sort of his background and interest, right, was physics.
Yes.
Also, probably a big part of why the game didn't work out quite the way that it wanted to. You talk a lot in the video about a concept that I'd never even heard of, actually, until you introduced it to me, which is penalty force physics. Can you explain that for us?
Okay, well, I'm no physics master myself, but my understanding from when I did my research is that when two objects collide, they will push away from each other at the equivalent force until they are not together anymore. Mm-hmm. So that was my basic understanding. I'm sure there's probably some physics person out there who's utterly screaming at that, but it's not something that doesn't get used in games too much. And Trespasser, from what I was looking at from interviews with people like Richard Wyckoff, who also worked on the game, is a very good example of why it doesn't get used, because it's very tough to code the friction in. And it basically meant that as a physics engine, in layman's terms, or in layperson's terms, excuse me, Trespasser is very good at knocking stuff over. Mm-hmm. It's, you can knock stuff over easily. When it comes to stacking stuff, it becomes really hard because there's so little friction. You just cannot stack things. The only things that are really stacked are things that have been carefully constructed beforehand. To actually stack a eye blocks yourself is very challenging, if not impossible, a lot of the time in the game.
And it's probably what they wanted the game to be, right? I mean, if you're building all this physics stuff and you know, I'm mostly judging the game by that opening area where there's just stuff everywhere, right?
it puts it all out in the open. I don't know if are you guys familiar with Old Man Moe?
Yeah, it's been a long time, obviously. Yes. But yeah,
one of the things that I ended up refinding as a result of research in Trespasser, they had the start to crate mm-hmm, scale, mm-hmm. And Trespasser in that regards is just off the charts, because crates are just the first thing you come across, hundreds of them, or dozens at least, and you just had to knock them all over. But they certainly want to do a lot. They wanted to do a lot more with the puzzling than the game, than what it basically is, which is you throw an item at a crate that's on a cliff and it comes down and then you jump on it.
I mean if we're making old internet references, what it made me think of from a similar era was a notion I first saw in Something Awful, which is probably where it came from, which is the term asshole physics.
Yes, asshole physics, yes.
Which I believe came about from Max Payne 2, and it's referring to physics that are so overdone that your character is sort of the stumbling idiot that's knocking everything over that they touch.
Yes, you just wreck everything touch. It's different from like physics that allow you to, you know, kill things in a thousand different ways. It's physics that allow you to be
I think my favorite sort of physics downfall with this game that you mentioned is the notion of your melee objects hurting you as you walk.
Yes, there are objects. Yes, they had to remove the mass because this was getting into the time when they had to, it was crunch time. They had no other solution for most of the items in the game. It's like, we have just have to remove the mass from all of them because they literally hurt you as you walk. I mean, if you use the catapult, there's one catapult in the game, and the catapult is live, but if as you walk, it gradually hurts Sam. You just hear it go until eventually Anne just drops dead. So there's three items in the game that I think they have any weight for them. There's a Dennis Nedry's mace, there's a skull, and weirdly there's an Easter egg which is just stuck in the world, which is a Quake logo that was just stuck in one of the levels. You can't actually access it ordinarily, you have to go into the no clip, but yeah, and that's weirdly those are like the only three items that are even remotely worthy as melee weapons.
So just to be clear, it's like she's carrying this weapon by her side, right? Like, and she's walking, yes. And it's just the momentum of this weighted object that she's walking is like hitting her in the leg or something over and over, right?
Yeah,
like,
yes, basically.
Even though she doesn't have legs.
Yes, I was just about to say, it would hit her in the leg if she had legs, which she does not, but it hits her in the cube.
So let's back up a minute before we talk about all of the...
Ow, my cube.
Before we talk about all of the crazy cuts to this game and compromises, because there's a lot of them, let's back up a second. What happened? Why did, this project that originally had all these millions of dollars thrown at it, and they said just, you know, it's done when it's done, finish it whenever. What happened? Why did they end up having to crunch?
So the story goes, as Seamus Blackley told it, was that one day, early 1998, the work was hard, but it was still going fine. DreamWorks just said one day, right, we've got this deal with AMD. And part of that deal is basically we need Trespass out by September, or it's the funding for the project's going to be pulled. And in Seamus's estimation, they still needed about 6 to 9 months beyond September in order to get Trespasser finished. By that stage, they'd done work on a lot of the parts, but they had yet to really put them together. Like dinosaurs, for example, had not been implemented in the world. They hadn't even tried to think about friction. A lot of the levels just weren't designed fully, like especially the first level, the beach, what that ended up being, and the levels at the end. A lot of them still had quite a bit of work needed to make them work. So the last 6 months or so of developing the game just became a desperate rush to get all these loose parts together into something that would function, ideally to a point where it actually work on most computers. But the trouble was, Trespass was not originally designed with the graphics cards in mind that had risen during the time of its development. It wasn't designed really with Voodoo in mind or anything like 3DFX. So that was another thing that really hurt the game, especially when on its full release, most players just could not run it.
Well, and you also talk in the film about sort of the lack of tools and optimization and stuff like that. I mean, they were just essentially creating 3D objects in 3D Studio Max and plopping them in.
Exactly. Yeah, they were trying to do most everything in 3D Studio Max, which again, I'm sure a lot of game developers, when you look at game developers, it's like, oh, well, we created our own programs for this. I think all they really had was like just a few scripts and that very basic like editor that they'd constructed, but nothing on the level of what a lot of games have. So yeah, there's definitely things there that they could have done differently.
So we're at a point where, you know, by their estimation, they're going to work on this game another, you know, year and a half ish. They've got a lot of probably assets created, right? Maybe nothing really optimized or anything. Levels not necessarily designed, but they might have environments, stuff like that. But you know, it's not really a game yet. And they've suddenly got 6 months to just sew it up and ship it out. I think what your video does a pretty remarkable job of demonstrating is, you know, how much of the game's failure you can essentially just see is due to them just not having time to just fix things.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the levels did end up being bashed together. There are obviously some quite famous levels that didn't make the game. Pine Valley, which I think was eventually used for the game's demo, or parts of it were. Other parts of levels just had to be bashed into one level. There was supposed to be a whole level based around a plantation house. I mean, when Trespasser is, when you get into like a level that's more full, say the town of Burrows, which is a very full level, you kind of see its potential very much realised. And then, but then when you get to the second half of the game, the ascent up Mount Watson, there's very little there. It almost seems like just you're in a straight corridor just with nothing but velociraptors. And it becomes a real drudge to the finish.
Well, I was thinking about like even how you demonstrated the dinosaur emotions, right? Like how, you know, there was this plan for them to have multiple emotive states that they could switch between randomly and stuff like that. And in the ship game.
Again, yes. Absolutely.
And in the ship game, they're essentially just aggro, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that sounds brilliant on paper, but then when they actually tried to put it in the level, the dinosaurs had all these emotions going on, and they just basically chose to do nothing. They just stood
kind
there.
Of beautiful, actually.
they cannot compute, so they don't know whether to be aggressive. They don't know whether to just ignore you. They just stood still.
They're feeling too many emotions all at once. They're paralyzed. Yeah,
it's very confused. Yes. So all they could do, yes, all they could do was just turn the aggression up to maximum on all the aggressive dinosaurs, the Velociraptor, Albertosaur, T-Rex, and turn the hunger up as well, which meant that they would at least fight with other dinosaurs. Other than that, yeah, that's all they could do. So basically most every dinosaur in the game just attacks you on sight.
And again, this is something that had they the time, they could have maybe tweaked it to get closer to the vision, right? Maybe not necessarily the fully realized the vision that they had in their heads that maybe
yes,
wasn't practical.
They could,
but right, they like it, and it's yeah, it's really unfortunate. But you know, I think you demonstrate really well though that like that you make me, even having not played the game, sort of see the potential, even in things like, you know, showing how the dinosaurs get confused with all the emotions at once. It's like, you know, that makes me realize like, well, it's probably working. You know, that probably means it's working as coded. There just needs to be tweaked.
I mean, they often appear confused enough in the game with the way they walk.
That's
about.
That's true.
Tripping over each other a lot.
Well, and like you show just even like shooting at a velociraptor, they just kind of like turn to the side and look around a little bit as you're shooting them.
Yes.
There are some great omissions you talked about too, some things that they had to get rid of. Like one of my favorites was that they could no longer make the raptors jump because they might fuse together in midair.
Yes. I mean, they already seem to be fusing with each other a lot of the time. Sometimes you see a raptor, it's like, oh my goodness, what happened to you? Your neck is compressed. I mean, I suppose one thing, if we go on to like Research Indicates Let's Play, which was where my original inspiration came from, my original interest in Trespass came from watching that years ago. One thing he always used to do after killing a velociraptor, if their neck was uncompressed, he'd touch it and always make sure that the neck, if he touched it, that the neck would suddenly spring back to normal. That was kind of ritual. couldn't just leave a dinosaur with a neck compressed.
Yeah, but you also point out a pretty beautiful moment from that Let's Play.
Yes.
Which is, you know, that after, I guess, a firefight with some raptors, what was it, a bronchiosaur or something?
I think, yes, it's between a velociraptor and a triceratops.
Yeah, the triceratops.
Oh, no, stegosaur.
Stegosaur. Right. You know, he kind of points out that, like, in this game where you're alone on this island, these friendly dinosaurs that just find themselves forced into these fights with you just come across as your only companions. And
yes, I know his Let's Play, I think it was originally released in 2008, I believe. It's still up on YouTube, obviously. And yes, it's a really beautiful Let's Play. He has such an appropriate voice for the matter. He knows a lot about the game and just kind of takes you on this journey. So as soon as I saw that, it's like, even though Trespass is supposed to be like this really bad game, it's like, ugh. Like, it really seems interesting. Like, even the Angry Video Game Nerd, when he did a video on Trespasser not too long back, kind of gave the game a certain respect that he got Seamus Blackley in for that one as well, but he gave it a certain respect that he wouldn't necessarily have afforded to something like Big Rigs. which does not deserve respect, but Trespasser is something that does.
Trespasser has ideas.
And I think that, you know, you sort of demonstrate this in the video, but I mean, the developers obviously, you know, clearly had much bigger plans for this. And I think you did a really good job of demonstrating that they were like real sad about this. Like they didn't want to release the game in this state, and they knew it could be so much better. And I mean, I might be jumping ahead of myself a little bit, but they like are completely into the fact that people are still keeping this game alive and fixing it, because they're like, yeah, this is what we wanted to do. There was good stuff here.
Oh, definitely. Yes. A lot of the interviews that I've read, Trescom has done a lot of interviews with people who worked on the game, and a lot of them are uniformly very enthusiastic about what they've done. They're still very happy to talk about Trespass and talk about the things that went wrong, the things that, you know, they were trying to do. So it's, I don't think there's too many people who worked on Trespass that are like closed books when it comes to the subject.
Yeah, it does seem like this, you know, for anyone who's talked about it anyway, this was a passion project. This was a dream project. It just got off the rails for business reasons.
Yes.
For sure. So where does the game succeed?
I think there are definitely moments when you go into the full levels where it really manages to create an atmosphere and has a lot of character. A lot of that, I do think, has to do with the narration that runs through the game. I think Richard Attenborough got involved, and I only had him for one day, but personally, I think he did a fantastic job with narration. There's moments when you, what will always be my favourite moment from the game, in the level called The Lab, is the Cray startup sequence. We actually have to full on start a Cray computer, and every time you press a button, you get another little piece of the narration that this is the big moment when it's like, is this fully going to work? Is this actual process going to happen? And, you know, there's a great sense of wonder about a sequence like that, a great sense of triumph at the end as it kind of builds up to this moment. So there's stuff like that, which I guess they probably got from working on games like System Shock, which kind of had that sort of telling. There's a lot of, obviously, well, it's been much almost entirely a story told in gameplay, which again is not something that a lot of games were doing at the time, so that narration really helps them with that. There's not much in the way of cutscenes or anything. I mean, even though obviously Half-Life would become more famous and was released just a month later, so there's sequences like that and other little Easter eggs that you can often find. I mean, sometimes you have little things like, obviously there's the Ozymandias secret ending, which you can find if you follow a hidden path. There's the floppy disk that you can find in the town, which has this very strange story that they recorded of John Parker Hammond recounting this event where he was snubbed by a girl in his younger years, and how that kind of shaped his motivations as a character, his motivations to create Jurassic Park. There's a lot of great world building in the game, I feel, and I think it does ought to be recognized a lot for that.
And again, this is a game that, as shipped, is essentially, you know, walking through environments and shooting dinosaurs, right?
Most of the time, yes. And I mean, it's such a shame they couldn't get dinosaurs inside the level, because the only thing about levels like the town is that most of it, there's only a few handful of dinosaurs in a big chunk of level. It's like if they could have got dinosaurs in the level, and maybe that would have been different. But again, it was just one of the things, time ran out. They just could not get it implemented without the game going utterly crazy.
So when this game ships, I mean, what's the reaction to it? I mean, obviously it's unfinished.
Well, the previews had been there'd been a lot of hype because they had been very open about the game in previews as to what they want to do. So the reaction to it was massive disappointment generally. I think GameSpot called it, the reviewer for GameSpot called it the most frustrating game he'd ever played and the most disappointing. And it got most disappointing game of the year, even worst game of the year in some magazines. So the reaction was very poor. I think it's also one of the least selling entries in all of the Jurassic Park franchise. It only shipped 20,000 or so units, which for Jurassic Park is... Well, it's not
for anything.
It's not for anything. But for Jurassic Park especially, that is just a tremendous flop. Yeah. So, yes, the reaction was just savage.
And part of that is, you know, it had some very obvious things to make fun of. It wasn't just like bad or frustrating game. You also had the protagonist with this like very hilarious noodle arm that can hold a shotgun.
Not even mentioned.
Well, yeah, why don't you explain the noodle arm?
Yes, the noodle arm. I mean, they were, yes, because the plan had been to have two arms. Anne was always going to have two arms. But
like this
again,
is a thing that you plan out.
Yes,
I mean, it is.
Obviously. Yeah, so that was always the idea, that two fully working arms, basically. But in the end, they could only include this one arm. The two arms, again, just made the physics and everything just didn't work with the time they had. So all Anne is one arm and a chest, which you constantly have to look down on because that's where your energy bar is. That is where you have this heart tattoo that fills up as you take damage. It was originally going to be on the left arm, the one that didn't make it.
Yeah, without that context, it feels just like gratuitously over-sexualized 90s junk,
yes,
you know?
It does feel like that, yes.
You have to stare down at your own chest.
Yes, you constantly have to stare down at your massive chest. And the reason it's so massive is to hide that she doesn't have any legs. Because when you look at there are a couple of concept drawings of Anne. I mean, the concept drawings of Anne, yeah, she has a regular sized chest. They're not 36 double D's we're talking about here. So yes, they just had to do that. So again, magazines, and also the arm itself, the one arm that there can be moved about in ridiculously unnatural ways. It and objects constantly clip through terrain, clip through objects in the world. Is the game just try its damnedest at every point to take you out of the world building and any of the positives that might be contained within, thanks to this noodle arm in the main.
Another bit about the noodle arm is just because this game is so reliant on physics. I mean, yeah, we talked about some of the downfalls of that, like your own weapons hitting you in the cube. But you know, you demonstrate in the video, I think a couple times, just the act of pressing buttons is, you know, like, because you are a physical arm in a physical space with physics. Yes, you'll point your hand out with a finger pointing, but it won't hit the button, and you just kind of have to walk your finger into the button.
You just walk your finger into it, yes, because that's what we do in real life, isn't it? We just walk around with our arms stretched out, and the hand can barely hold on to stuff a lot of the time. Like the second it even slightly touches anything, an object can go flying off who knows where. And you know, best case scenario, it just lands normally. Worst case scenario, it puts an entire hole, which everything gets sucked through and the game crashes. It tears a hole in the universe. And objects, again, like there's so many times when an object, you know, gets dropped, will disappear into a wall. And you can actually, if you keep pushing your arm there, you will be able to literally fish that object out of that wall. just because an object goes into a wall doesn't mean that you've lost it forever.
Look, I got through once, I can get through again.
It's a lot of Absolutely. Complicated physics at play here. Very yes. realistic.
Isla Sorna is basically half just void.
Kim, do you think the game might have come close to their vision with more time, or do you think, you know, it was kind of overscoped from the start?
I think it was overscoped from the start. I mean, I think it would have certainly been an okay game in the end if they'd had enough time. But I do think that in perhaps the time it was released, it was a little overambitious. And also, if you put into the context of the games that were going to come out, again, as mentioned, Half-Life 1 comes out just a month later and takes the mantle for environmental storytelling, well, takes the mantle for gaming as a whole, for PC gaming. Trespasser, even at its best, would have really struggled to compete with something like Half-Life, let alone System Shock 2, Deus Ex, and any other game that comes out in the months to come, years to come. So it would have struggled. I mean, it certainly wouldn't have been as bad a game as it ended up being. But would it be remembered as an all-time great game? Perhaps not. It's certainly one of those games that would have, well, it has a cult following now, despite the state that it was released in, and I certainly think that's something it would always have had.
So you do talk about the fan community quite a bit, and I do want to get into that. But before we do, a question just comes to mind immediately for me, which is this a game that over the years has attracted a new cult following, or is the community mostly composed of people who were excited for the game before it came out?
I think there's a lot of battle-hardened folks in the Trespasser community, but then there are also, I mean, there's a channel on YouTube I found, Clayton Fioriti, I hope that's how it pronounced, as nearly 300,000k subscriber channel that almost entirely is covering mods for Trespasser. Wow. I mean, there's a lot of other Jurassic Park items here as well, but a lot of it is Trespasser mods, and that kind of surprised me. It's like, so certainly there is some audience for Trespasser mods that isn't just the people who have been around since 1998. It must still attract some people here and there. And again, when you go back to items like Research Indicates Let's Play, I mean, that is still one of the most popular Let's Plays for the game. And you have other videos by quite popular creators, AVGN, of course. G-Man Lives, I believe, has also done quite a big video on Trespasser. So we still talk about it. And as long as we still talk about it generally, it will attract more people in. Because I do think that, irregardless of, as we've mentioned, there is a lot that's appealing about Trespasser, even if someone's telling you, oh, it's a bad game, it's a game that looks like one you want to play when you're just watching it.
And you mentioned that this community, I mean, this was people who started trying to hack the game, like starting in 1998, 1999. They were like, okay, yes, this is bad, but we can fix this, or we want to fix this.
Yes, yes.
How did that all come together?
And I think there was Game Developer Magazine, Richard Wyckoff, one of the programmers, did a post-mortem, and he did say, I don't see how anyone can do this. I mean, it barely functioned with the tools that we had, and we made the bloody thing. But obviously, people on the internet never take no for an answer, do they? So they kept bashing their head against the wall, and eventually, after a few years, they managed to succeed. You know, when I was looking through the archives, I found a lot of great work, all of which is still archived on Trescom, which is very useful. Trescom.org being the main site for Trespass. With, you don't know, I mean, a lot of the old sites that I found, sites like Trespasser Secrets, Tresview, like the original site for that, Charles T.S. or Hughes' site. Those were all archived on Trescom.org. It wasn't a case where I had to find old links from who knows where and then put them in the Wayback Machine. Everything was there still.
What a good community.
Which was very convenient as a researcher.
That sounds amazing.
Well, I mean, what else are they going to do? maybe that sounds rude, but it's like, you know, like that. If that's the community, there can't be that much to focus on, right? And
well, it is a small community, yes, and you know, it's not as obviously as big. It's never going to be as big as obviously the Doom community still is, or the Half-Life community. It is a small, dedicated bunch of people. So even if things may move slower, I suppose that does also mean that anything that does come out does get, you know, appropriate justice. It gets a good audience. It's always guaranteed to get a good audience from them.
I think anyone who's listening, who's on the team, who took stuff home, should put that source code online for this awesome community and give them an easier time. Have they been trying to social engineer that?
I think there's been a lot of work on that, and I think they've done quite a few steps on that front.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I would, you know, the developers of this game clearly care about this game, just given the fact Absolutely. That they've done all these interviews on the site. I mean, that's where a good amount of your research on sort of the developers' thoughts on this game come from, right? Is just that they had a bunch of interviews already with these developers.
Yes, it was a case of like looking at the interviews that they've done, interviews that were archived at the time to see like what the ideas were before the actual reality of the game came through. So there was a lot of notes that I found from quite a long period, again, things like the post-mortem, which came out only a few months after the game, to interviews that Seamus Blackley, for example, has done in Retro Gamer just a few months ago, in fact. So the research that I found, the notes that I found, covered a very long period of time.
So this fan community, I mean, they've done a lot of work on the game over the years. They're not just modding new things, and they're essentially, in some ways, restoring intent, right?
As much as they can. Obviously, they are limited in a lot of things you can do. There's a lot of things you just can't do, obviously, without a source code. But I think the best thing is that they've made it so it's very easy for anyone to really to play Trespasser. You can play Trespasser on a modern system in 60 frames per second, 1080p resolution, no problem, thanks to the mod. So,
and that's a big deal. You demonstrated how poorly it was running on on computers during the day.
Yes, I used a PCM emulator to sort of demonstrate just how it runs, even at 640 by 480 on a system that of the time it runs in about 5 FPS a second. 5 to 10 FPS a lot of the time. So it's not an entirely closed off community. They've tried their best actually to keep this game as open as possible to someone who would want to get into Trespasser, which I think is excellent.
You know, watching this video and thinking about this game, I get a lot of feelings similar to when I'm exploring a game that didn't ship at all. That maybe has some bits and pieces that survived. And you know, watching your video, watching clips from other people's videos, etc., I'm not inspired to, you know, install the game and play it raw, right? But I am inspired by what I'm seeing. And I think there's something to that. I think that, and this is maybe getting a little philosophical, but I think you can restore a game like an unfinished work or an unreleased work or whatever in people's minds without restoring an entire game into a playable product.
Yes, the critical opinion on Trespasser, I think, has certainly evolved over the years compared to what it was when it was released into something that, again, is seen as an interesting failure. And speaking as a documentarian video maker, those sort of games for me are the most interesting to cover. The things that do have these dedicated communities, it's not necessarily as interesting to cover a game that was just an automatic home run. That, everything went great, you know, the game itself is exactly as envisioned. I mean, that in itself is very rare, but it's also, well, you know, congratulations, you know, applause, obviously. But the interesting failures, the ones where things did go on or when, you know, something just had to be pulled out of the fire, no matter what, are the ones that just tend to just have the best stories about them a lot of the time. And that is also far more rewarding than just taking a game like that and going, oh, it's terrible, it's crap, it's rubbish, and so on, and other stronger words.
And I think, you know, it's one thing to have a game that has ambitions and you can read about the ambitions and that sort of thing, but through both a fan community, you know, that's dedicated enough to actually show and illustrate what some of these things might look like in a maybe not completely fixed state, but in a more correct state. And then also with the help of documentarians like yourself, sort of putting that in its context. I guess I'm basically just echoing what Frank is saying. It's like, it's not, it's a step above just knowing that this was an ambitious game. Like, now this is a game that can live and breathe in people's minds for what it was truly meant to be.
Definitely, 100%. I think that's definitely testament to what Trescom have done as a website.
And I think of it as archaeology, right? It's, you know, we can't completely rebuild ancient Egypt or whatever, but, you know, we can piece together the clues that we have from what survived, in this case, what, you know, made it into the shipped game, and bring it alive more in your mind than in, you know, in reality.
And in the end, isn't that what Jurassic Park is in a way all about? I mean, we can't rebuild. We can't rebuild dinosaurs. Dinosaurs themselves are just fossils. I mean, we can give them. There are dinosaurs around that probably didn't exist at all back in those days. And the Iguanodon, I think, is one famous example that this dinosaur was not anywhere near like it's often pictured, but it still has the feeling of the dinosaurs when you look at that as a youngster, especially. That gives you that sense of wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know, I guess a similar thing would be, you know, watching the dinosaurs sort of, you know, notice each other and start fighting each other instead of you. It's like you get a glimpse of what they were going for there.
Absolutely, yes. You suddenly feel like, I mean, it can look a bit silly because of the game, but it's, you get that slight sense, yes, when you're suddenly watching like two velociraptors trying to take on a T-Rex and inevitably failing.
So for this project specifically, Kim, this video, was this an easy one to research because it just had such a following already and had, you know, a postmortem in Game Developer Magazine, or you know, was it tricky to piece all this together?
The research itself was pretty easy for this one, again, because a lot of the notes were there. The actual, like, putting this video together, or the idea, I had an idea to do Trespasser, a full video on it, that is, years ago. But it took me time to obviously get to, you know, ideas like just sit in your head, and then finally I kind of feel, okay, I reckon it's time to actually do this now. I can't remember why I actually decided now is the time. I think maybe it's from a retro gamer reading Seamus Blackley's look at it. Actually, no, it was. I did start doing Jurassic Park. I did like a video on like the Mega Drive game and was going to do like, oh, I'll do like the SNES game, I'll do the Mega CD game and whatever. When really Trespasser is the one that I actually just wanted to do. So I kind of decided, okay, I'm not going to do all those games. I'm just going to do Trespasser and devote time to making a 80-minute video on the game, because again, it's something that I'd wanted to do for quite some time. So yeah, the actual research, the actual putting together of the video was not as, it's certainly not the most tricky one I've done, but I think in the end it's one of the most satisfying ones, I would say.
And I would say a really cool thing that you did, you mentioned this briefly, was emulating a PC of the time. To make viewers see for themselves what it was
like. Yes, you have to show the viewers at the end of the day. I mean, I could talk about how it runs at 5 frames per second or how it ran in 1998, but if I'm just showing the modded versions of the game, the ATX mod and so on, you know, your viewers not going to get that feeling, really. And, I mean, I am only limited in my tools. I don't have space for like a vintage PC of the time as such, unfortunately, that I could run a Trespasser on, but that's as close as I can get. And so, yeah, it gives people that feeling of like, this is how it ran. And again, that was something, because I noticed, again, going back to AVGN's video on the game, I noticed that was something that he did too, which I think, again, is more authentic, more accurate to like, this is how the game actually looks, rather than running the mods.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you specifically said even at the beginning of the video, like, I'm going to show you what a player experienced in 1998. Like, because that is important. I mean, it's, you can't judge. You can say, you know, you can give all the facts and everything, but you can't really have an accurate judgment of why people reacted this way without seeing it the way that they saw it.
Yeah, sometimes as YouTubers, you've just got to do the hardest thing that we are able to do, which is be quiet and just let the viewer decide for themselves.
And, you know, actually, I think, hopefully this doesn't come across the wrong way, but my favorite moments in your video are when you let the game breathe and speak, because there are a lot of moments of quiet, introspective beauty in this mess of a game.
Absolutely.
And I don't know, it's hard not to be charmed by this thing.
I mean, as a package, when you just look, again, when you're looking at the sound and the a lot of the graphics, when it's not going haywire with physics, is a beautiful thing. I mean, the music in the game is excellent. They the composer was just asked, oh, can you give us something John Williams-esque, because they didn't have rights to the actual music, and did it, no problem. And it sounds beautiful, and there's moments like when you just come into Burrows and you're just exploring this town, maybe trying to shoot a basketball, which you can do, which are quite wonderful, and like you get that sense of wonder.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for joining us on the Video Game History Hour. Everyone go check out the video. It's great. We'll link to it in the show notes, but other than that, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And yes, if you're interested in what I've been talking about and what I do after listening to me babble for an hour, you can find me on YouTube if you just search Kim Justice. I'm on Twitch. I'm a Twitch streamer as well. If you go to twitch.tv/Kim_Justice, I have a Patreon where I make my notes and also do wrestling videos, which is kind of another feather in my bag. You can do that on patreon.com/KimballJustice. And if you just want to see me talk shit, then go to twitter.com/KimXXXJustice.
And in particular, what I enjoy from Kim's channel, just recommendation-wise, is breadth of knowledge of British microcomputer garbage that I will I would never yes, have experienced otherwise.
Plenty of British microcomputer, plenty of Spectrum, plenty of Amiga, plenty of all that good stuff. Not enough of it about on YouTube.
All right. Well, thank you again, Kim. This is great.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter @GameHistoryHour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.